My name is Megan O'Neill, and I'm here with Lenny Caldwell in Fentel Library in Salem, Virginia. It's 5 p.m. on Thursday, February 23rd, 2017. And so let's start from the beginning. Can you tell us some about your childhood or where you went to school?
Sure. I grew up in Blacksburg, Virginia, and went to school at Blacksburg High School. It was back in the day where we basically went from elementary right to high school. So I was in high school in the 70s in Blacksburg.
Do you feel like growing up in the South really impacted you as a person, impacted your development? Do you consider Virginia the South?
That's a good question. I guess I do consider it the South. Perhaps not the Deep South. It's definitely not Alabama, Mississippi, but it's still not the North. I guess I consider Virginia part of the Bible Belt. So in that sense, it's definitely the South. And I guess I don't know whether it's growing up in Virginia, you know, that's the only place I grew up, so I don't have anything to compare it with. If it was that, or if it was the era in which I grew up, I was born in the 50s, and so I think at that time in our country, there was a bit more homogeneous culture, I think, throughout the country, and I was definitely raised in a culture that was Southern as far as politeness and rules and manners and stuff like that. But again, I don't know if that was so much the location as the time.
Okay.
But yeah.
So did you stay in Virginia after high school, or did you go out of Virginia for your higher ed?
Yeah, I graduated from Blacksburg, and I didn't want to go to Virginia Tech just because I already had a lot of association with Tech, actually, which I'd like to talk about that. We'll see how we spiral back to that. But I went to Radford, and at the time it was Radford College, which is now Radford University. I was there for 2 years, and after I left, that next year is when Radford went co-ed. So when I was there, Radford was an all-girls school. So I was at Radford College for 2 years, and then I transferred to Old Dominion University, which is in Tidewater in Northern Virginia, and graduated college there.
So why did you decide to transfer? Was it a two-year program, or did you transfer for...
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me see where to go with that. In college... It's hard to know how to balance both of these pieces of my life. I fell in love with a woman, and this was in the early 70s, and again, in Radford. And at that time, we didn't even really know that there were other women like us. We felt very much isolated. It was a sort of a out of the blue kind of an experience of just falling in love. So we were roommates there for those 2 years, and then she was actually from the Tidewater area. And to tell you the truth, I'm not exactly sure what made us think about moving, but we decided to move back to where she was from, live in an apartment. We both finished then at Old Dominion. So that was the reason we left. That whole experience is definitely a big part of my story. And we had mentioned earlier off the tape that a big thread that runs through my story is the intersection between sexuality and spirituality. So I'll go back a little bit to my high school experiences. I became involved through some older students, older friends who were a part of what was going on. And again, this was in the late 60s, and there was a lot of the anti-war movement happening at Virginia Tech. And somehow I kind of fell into all of that with these older students and loved it at that point. So I had a bit of a taste of the hippie movement, the counterculture, while I was still in high school as a part of Virginia Tech. And then kind of right on top of that, there were a bunch of Virginia Tech students who started reaching out to Blacksburg High School and formed this Christian youth group. And again, I kind of fell into that. My childhood didn't involve really any religious experience. We went to church on holidays, pretty much, you know, Easter, Christmas, that kind of thing. There was not a consistent involvement in a church. My parents were not necessarily religious. But I fell into this whole Jesus movement thing as a high school student at Virginia Tech. And it was, as I've looked back on it now, with some years of hindsight, I realized that it was not just a religious experience, but it was a social experience. For me, it was trying to find a place where I belonged, where I felt connected, where I had community, where I had family. And I think that that's also part of what I was looking for in the whole hippie movement business, although part of the hippie movement for me involved a sense of rebellion. I had a lot of anger and rebellion that I didn't really understand. Again, a lot of this has come in insight as I've looked back. I grew up an only child. Both my parents are alcoholics. And again, I grew up in that, and so it just felt natural. It was all I knew, but it affected me. It certainly impacted my development, my sense of security, and I had a lot of anger toward my parents that I thought was just cultural rebellion, but now I look back and you know, can see some of the psychological, sociological basis of some of that. But so here I am in college, feeling finally like I found a family, I've connected, there's this huge community that I'm a part of, and then suddenly I fall in love with a woman, which at that point set me personally on a somewhat of a schizophrenic journey, I think, for the rest of my life, or at least for a long period of my life, where I was trying to make sense between, like I said, sexuality and spirituality. But so that's that's how I got to Tidewater. That was all part of moving with my girlfriend.
Okay, so just want to go back to clarify a little bit. So when you were in high school and you joined into these, like the hippie movement and this religious community, did you feel like you were struggling to find community before that, or was that just when you really found like your niche?
Good question. That's interesting. I don't think I thought about it. I don't really recall having many memories up until that time in my life. It feels like it was mostly a blank slate. And that's another piece of my development, which again, years of therapy. We're talking a lot of money has gone into therapy through my years. And it feels like my life began in high school when I had those connections and those relationships, which makes it even more meaningful and significant that I felt outcast, that I felt rejected and not accepted for who I was as a lesbian by this Christian community that I had begun to embrace. So I don't know that I was actually searching or that I was aware that anything was missing. I feel like that up until that point, I was just sort of putting one foot in front of the other and just very numbly living life. I think I was pretty numb.
Okay. So when you did fall in love with this woman in college, do you feel like you struggled with the religious, and did you maintain your connections with this hippie community through college as well as the Christian community?
Yeah, the hippie community stuff kind of faded off and was replaced by the Jesus movement. And that's a whole sociological period of time in our history, which is an interesting study in and of itself. The 60s, the 70s were an amazing time, I think, in history of the Christian church, because the Jesus movement was a point in time where I think the church caught on fire. It was phenomenal for me. And again, I've lived a few years and I've been in a lot of different churches since then. And I feel like the life that I experienced in those days was closer to what I feel like the Bible described Jesus and his experience and walking with people in the first century. So that didn't fade away. That's what I'm saying, is that it was so important to me. I was telling someone the other day, the dilemma that I found myself in was feeling like I had to choose between the two people that I love the most in this earth, and that was Nancy and Jesus. And I, for whatever reason, cultural, societal, my own stuff, whatever it was, I didn't feel like it was okay. I didn't have permission to love both. And so for many years, it was that struggle of loving one or the other. And so I tended to immerse myself either in the Christian world and deny my sexuality, or kick God to the curb and not want to have anything to do with religion, and then express myself as a feminist, as a lesbian. But not until much later in life did I figure out how to balance those two.
So what did your life look like after graduation? Did you continue your life with Nancy for a long period of time, or what did you do after college?
Unfortunately, Nancy and I did not continue a long-term relationship, again, because of that conflict. I was much more into the religious part of life than she was, and I think eventually it just became a stress on our relationship that I kept dealing with guilt. I felt very guilty about loving her, and so it was, again, this off and on, I love you, but I can't love you. I love you, but I can't love you. And she finally had an affair, which at the time devastated me, absolutely devastated me. And so that ended our relationship, and we were living in an apartment together, so we moved out, and I continued in the Tidewater area for a few years. I did various sundry things after I graduated. I graduated with a degree in psychology, which at that point in time doesn't really equip you to do a whole lot. But this was 1976, I guess, that I finished at Old Dominion. And so I stayed, and I've always loved children. I've always been very involved with kids, even in high school, babysitting in the summers, in people's homes, keeping lots of kids, teaching vacation Bible school, those kinds of things. So I've always had this affinity toward children, and I think I did that for a few years. Then I actually started teaching in Christian schools, so that was the next journey, the next step of my life was teaching.
So, were you teaching religious teachings, or was it just like the typical public school, like math, reading kind of thing?
Yeah, it was what's called Christian schools. So it was small, private Christian schools that I've taught in. I guess maybe three different. One, the first was down there in the Tidewater area, and again, it was a church-sponsored school. So I think we had, is making me remember many, many years ago. I'm really trying to remember how young, if there were kindergartners. I know I taught 5th, 6th, and 7th, which was an interesting thing because it was all three of those grades. But again, it was a very small school, so I probably had anywhere from 18 to 20 students in those three grades. And at that time, it was a curriculum that was designed where students were doing their own individual things. So it was very self-paced, and I did a lot of just monitoring. So that was that first experience. Then I ended up moving back to the Roanoke area where my parents are. Again, my parents were still in Blacksburg at that point, but I moved to Roanoke. So that was my first experience with Roanoke, was in probably in the late 70s, early 80s. I was teaching at a Christian school here in Roanoke. Again, another small Christian school, part of a church, and I taught fifth grade there. And it was teaching everything, all the subjects.
So you really liked kids before this. Did you think that was a really fulfilling part of your life? Did you really enjoy teaching?
Kids have always been a super fulfilling part of my life. I've always wanted to be a mother. I've always had a very strong, nurturing, caring part of me, which, again, I think is a piece of the conflict that was set up for me in terms of who I was as a sexual person, because in my mind, again, whether the culture actually said this to me or whether it was how I interpreted it, at that point in time in the 70s and the 80s, it was my belief that to be a mother, I had to have a husband. So it was this package deal of the white picket fence, the husband, the family, the children. To even consider going outside the realm of that at that time was not part of my thinking.
Mm-hmm. So you got that, like, the fulfillment from children through teaching?
Through teaching at that point.
So when you moved, just thinking about this, when you moved to Tidewater with Nancy, did your parents, had you been out to your parents about your relationship with Nancy, or was that something that hadn't been?
I was not really out to anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of hard to be out to other people when you're not really out to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the answer to that is no.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's interesting, years and years later, after my father had died, I had this conversation with my mother and coming out to her, and she looks at me like, this is news. Mm-hmm. So even when Nancy and I were together, my mom knew that we were more than just roommates, that we were more than just friends. But the culture didn't know that, and society didn't know that, and this circle of Christian friends that my family had become did not know that, which made that breakup with Nancy even more devastating for me. Because in the eyes of everybody else, what's the big deal? Your roommate just moved out, you know. Why is that so significant? No one had any idea that this is a woman that I'd lived with for over 3 years that I was madly in love with, and I didn't feel the freedom, not out to anybody.
So when you got home, did you feel like, did you find that community again, that religious community, to try to immerse yourself in to deal with that heartbreak? Or how did you cope with it for a while?
Oh, that's a good question of how I coped with the heartbreak. I coped with the heartbreak by adding a whole lot more salt to the Atlantic Ocean. We lived very close to the ocean, so I could actually walk, and I did. I walked up and down the beach probably every night, just crying my eyes out, just bawling. But again, feeling very isolated and very alone. There was no one that I could share that pain or that grief or that loss with. And I don't think that I was sharing it with God either. I think that because I felt so guilty and so ashamed of loving Nancy, that my whole relationship with God in that grieving was just, you know, I'm such a horrible person, forgive me for this. So it wasn't even a healthy grieving in my relationship with God, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So we're teaching in Roanoke. Where do we go from here? What is the next step that you took?
Next step was, and actually this step began when I was in Virginia Beach. Nancy and I had become a part of a church in Virginia Beach that was a very missions-oriented church, and I don't know if that means anything to you in terms of just the whole Christian world, but this was a church that a lot of people would go out from to, you know, share about the love of Jesus in other countries. And suddenly I felt like that's what I wanted to do. And so I sort of started down that path of pursuing, where will I go? And it brings me back to those many, many, many months that I would walk along the beach and cry. I think I came to a decision, whether it was conscious or not, that I would just give my life to God for the rest of my life, and I would not be a sexual being. You know, if I couldn't be who I was, I just wouldn't be sexual. And so I just was devoted to totally gonna share the love of Jesus with the whole world. And what happened is I got involved with this group, and I ended up going to Japan. So that was my next step, was I'm heading overseas for the rest of my life. And I look back on it now, and I say, just how far can you run from your sexuality? Well, I tried running to Japan, and I was there for 3 months. That was the intention of that first experience, was to just, it was a summer thing. So then I came back to Roanoke, to this church where I was teaching, and where that church was totally in favor of me being a missionary, going to live, spend the rest of my life in Japan. So that was the trajectory that I was on. The interesting thing is that, and I so believe that this was God, that there was a plan for me to find myself, to really accept who I am as a queer person. Didn't use that term then, but the term that I use now in identifying myself is queer. And so part of my, okay, I've spent a summer in Japan, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, involved this little stop along the way in Southern California, because there was a group there, a place where I could learn all about the mission field and where missionaries came back when they were on furlough, things like that. And where in Southern California there's a large Japanese population, I could learn the culture, I could learn the language. So that's what I did, is I headed out in 1984 to Southern California. Everything I owned and my little dog was packed in my Volkswagen Bug, and off we went cross country. Now, little did I know how that was going to change my life. So I'll stop and you can...
How did that change my life? What turn of events came to that? Why aren't you still in Japan kind of thing? What happened in Southern California?
I got stuck. I landed in Southern California in the 80s, and there are a few gay people in Southern California. Okay, just a few. And by this day and time, they were a bit more out than the gay people who were around me here in Southwest Virginia. So, you know, part of what I want to talk about, and I know somewhat the thrust of this is like what was like in Roanoke. And I talked, you know, with Dr. Rosenthal about the fact that I don't really have a whole lot of experience with that. I do a little bit, and we'll come back to that. But at this point, my experience in Southern California was my eye-opening experience to the gay world, to the fact that there were gay and lesbian people who were accepting of themselves and very out and very open. I didn't expect that. I had no idea that that was why God was taking me to California. But that's why God was taking me to California. So rather than doing whatever, however long I was going to stay there and then head on to Japan, I never left California. I ended up staying there for about 10 years.
So when you got to California, did you feel like the queer culture and like being out and being comfortably out, do you think that was just a stepping stone to integrating your sexuality and religiosity? Like, did you have to be around people that... being out was culturally acceptable?
Eventually. And it was perhaps a stepping stone, but it was a far distant stepping stone from the final ultimate stepping stone, because what California gave me was an experience in the culture of the ex-gay ministries. And again, I don't know if that term means anything to you, but there are still some of these that exist now. and unfortunately so. But back in the, you know, 70s and 80s, particularly before the American Psychological Association and the DSM had actually said that psychology, that being queer was not a disorder, there were all of these Christian organizations that rose up to say, you can be healed. God can save you from being gay. And I say, unfortunately, I fell into one of those. Again, remembering for me what I said earlier, that conflict of feeling like I was being forced to choose between the two people that I love the most. And so for this period of time in my life, large period, when I first got to California, I was still connected with this Jesus movement, very strong culture of Christians. And so the people that I met were people who were saying, it's a sin to be gay, and God can heal you. So for probably 2 years, maybe a little less, I was involved in one of those kinds of ministries.
What led you to leave that ministry at one point?
I finally just had enough. I think I finally reached a point that I just said, this is not me. You know, I tried. I really, really tried hard not to be gay. And it just wasn't working. Thank God it didn't work. And so I think finally I just had had enough. And unfortunately, that meant that I got very angry at God. So by the time I left Southern California, it was that phase of my life where I kicked God to the curb, and I was over it. I was just so angry and frustrated with the Christian everything. But that gave me permission that allowed me to then explore what it was like to be a lesbian, what it was like to be in the gay culture. So that's where I was when I came back to Virginia.
So you said God led you to Southern California. So you were meant to have that period of time in your life where you didn't accept God or you denied God in your life. So that was a learning period.
Great question. You know, I believe very strongly that God has had a hand on me all of my life. And even though there have been times that I might have on the external part of me said, I don't want to have anything to do with God, there is a deep, deep part of me that is very connected to the spiritual. And I have come to the place in my life currently where I believe there are all kinds of names of God, but that God is God. There is spirit. And so, yes to that question. I think that as much as I struggled in this small human experience of making sense between my sexuality and my spirituality, there was an overarching spirit that just is so above all that shit. I hope that's okay to use that word on this day, because that's what it is. It's just crazy human stuff, and the truth is so far above that. So I feel very strongly that, yes, God took me there, and that even when I said, I don't want to have anything to do with Christianity, that didn't hurt God's feelings. God didn't go anywhere. God was perfectly okay. And now I'm back to where I am at this point. So, yeah, I think that was all part of my evolution, I think. You know, just kind of thinking of the seasons and the evolution of my life to get to where I am now.
Okay. So you came back to Virginia as more or less like an empowered lesbian, like proud to be who you are.
I was getting there.
So where did you go from there?
Yeah, then I landed in the Roanoke area. Mm-hmm. And that's the little bit of taste that I have of what was happening here in Roanoke. And again, you know, I think a lot had been happening in Roanoke prior to that point. So I landed back here in the early 90s. And at that point, found a group of women called, an organization called First Fridays. And so the First Fridays was a group of lesbians. Most of them were from the Roanoke area. A few came from the New River Valley or, you know, Lynchburg or Bedford, other places. But the core were people who lived in Roanoke. And we met once a month, the first Friday of every month. So that was my first real experience of connecting again with a group. And I just thought about this, how, you know, the theme of my life, like I said, and I think this stems back to my early childhood abuse, neglect, my parents' alcoholism, all of those kinds of things. I was always searching for that place to belong, for that family, that community, that connection. And whether it was the hippie movement, whether it was the Jesus movement, whether it was all these various churches that I've been a part of, at this point in the early 90s, it was this lesbian circle. And along with that, I was also somewhat involved with a women's reading group that was happening at Virginia Tech. And this was mostly professors and students from Tech. So it was those two things that, yeah, were helping me to find out about. And again, it's kind of funny to say that I began to really explore the whole gay culture back here in Roanoke when I just lived in Southern California for 10 years. But again, I was conflicted when I was in California.
So when you were here in Roanoke, what kind of work were you doing? What kind of work were you doing with First Friday?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Work-wise, I was teaching again, so it was that same thing of being back here and, oh no, that's not true. No, when I came back in the 90s, okay, this is part of what I did in Southern California is get a master's degree. So I had my undergraduate degree in psychology. In Southern California, I taught in Christian schools again, and so while I was teaching, I also went to grad school in the evening. So I taught during the day and went to grad school and got a master's degree in marriage and family child therapy. And another really interesting evolution that happened when I was in Southern California, I mentioned to you the whole thing of how I've always loved kids and how I've always wanted to be a mother. I had a significant experience that I think is important in my evolution. Like I said, I'd always kind of, in my mind, associated that to be a mother, I had to be a wife. And so I was still going down that road and was dating this guy in my graduate program. And so the two of us were pretty close. He was a very nice guy. And, you know, we were beginning to be close. No sexual relationship at that point. And we went on a weekend trip to San Francisco for a conference, and we stopped along the way. And I don't know how this conversation came about, but I'll never forget it. We're just kind of standing there at this park looking over the ocean. And he says, you know, I don't think I really want to be a parent. I don't have any desire to have children. And something in me just clicked at that point. And I said, that's it. I'm done. I don't need a man to be a mother. I am done. And that was so freeing. That was so exciting. So by the time I got back to Roanoke, these little thoughts and the stirring, and again, it's 1990, okay? So there's a bit of a role model out there that you don't have to have a husband to be a mother. And so when I came back, that was really where I was headed, was I was considering, what will I do with my career, which, again, was psychology, counseling, therapy. That's always been my main interest. And how will I fulfill this desire to be a parent? So when I got back, I applied at various places, ended up getting a job with an agency called Connections. It's a specialized foster care agency. And I worked with two groups of people. The first group was Southeast Asian refugees, and these were minors who had come from Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, which was interesting, so it takes me right back circle to, you know, my interest in Southeast Asia and Nam and all of that. And at the same time, I also started working with children in foster care who had significant emotional, psychological issues. And so that was what I was doing career-wise, and I did that for about 7 years as a social worker.
So since you had gotten in your mind that you were going to be a mother, how did you go about doing that? Did you look into adopting, fostering children, because that's what you're going into professionally?
Bingo. That's exactly. And again, I think this is all that path, you know, that I feel led by spirit. After about 7 years of being a social worker, I just kind of woke up, I guess. You know, it feels like it was I woke up one day, but I know it had been coming. And I marched over to the Department of Social Services, and I had a lot of relationships. The agency that I worked for was a private agency, but we contracted with a lot of the local departments. They would send us their kids. So I just basically made an appointment with the director and said, you know, here I am. I have a master's in marriage and family therapy. I've been a social worker for 7 years. I'd like to be a foster parent. But I want to be a foster parent that provides these direct services to these very needy, challenged children. Because what was happening and what still often happens is children come into foster care and their needs are so intense and they're so severe, they become assigned to this separate agency. But unfortunately, sometimes it's many different placements and moves before they get there. My personal feeling is that that's the worst thing our system does to kids. Kids are already removed one time from their parents. They don't need to have multiple losses and changes and moves from foster family to foster family. So I went to Roanoke City, and I said, here I am. And they basically accepted me and, you know, said, yeah, you know, we will make you. And I was basically the very first parent with Roanoke City that was a specialized foster parent.
Did you being a lesbian or being even a single mom affect any
of
that?
Do you think I was out at that point, Megan? Okay. All right. It's 1990. I've gone through a lot of my personal stuff, but my sense of what was going on in Roanoke, even at that time in First Fridays, is that there were still plenty of us who were very closeted. It was still an era where you could lose your job. You could lose a lot by being out. So even though it was the early 90s, it wasn't the kind of freedom that we have today. So, no, I was not marching over to social services as an out lesbian. I was marching over there as a qualified person to do this job, and I was marching over as a single person, so the fact that I was a lesbian didn't really come up. It wasn't an issue at that point.
Was the single mother an issue, or is it just since you were so qualified, that was less of a...
Yeah, that's interesting, is that at least in Roanoke, for quite some time, they have been very open about approving single male and single female. Now, obviously, I think there are more women who are single parents, but Roanoke City was open. I will say a nice plug that Roanoke City has moved, and at this point in time, they approve gay and lesbians as well. State of Virginia does not allow a lesbian couple to adopt or a gay couple to adopt. So if I were in a relationship and wanting to adopt, it would be either my partner or myself. I don't know exactly how that's changed now that we have equality and there's marriage. I'm not really particularly up on the legality of that piece. But for me, I became a single foster parent.
Was your goal to adoption at any point, or was it just fostering?
Yeah. You know, I've always, you know, ever since I've thought about being a parent, been very open to adoption. Always thinking, you know, gosh, there are children out there who need families. Why not be that family? My intention when I became a foster parent was very influenced by my training, and my background as a marriage and family therapist is in systems and in believing that children have those connections with their biological family, and my goal was to support that. And philosophically, I still really do believe that. But again, I feel that God had other plans, because the first two children who came into my care were two young boys. Scotty was 4, Carl was 7. They came to me in 1996, and they're still my children. They're part of my 3 kids. I have 3 children.
So 2 boys, and then who's the third?
I have a daughter who is 20 now.
So foster care, working as a social worker at this point, So you mentioned you weren't out in the 90s. Is that a fairly new thing? Is that something...
To be out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably because, again, the being fully out comes back to that conflict of the spiritual and the sexual being integrated. So what I described earlier is that for me... I tended to deal with it like a seesaw. That's kind of my visual image, that I could be a lesbian and spirituality wasn't a part of my life, or I could be a Jesus follower and sexuality was not a part. It was just this damn seesaw. But when I came back to California, to Virginia from California, I was in that phase where I didn't want to have anything to do with God. And that lasted for a while, but I suddenly felt empty. That didn't fit. That's not me. And so I landed at the Unitarian Church, which for me was a good bridge. The Unitarian Church here in Roanoke is amazing. And at that particular time, the pastor was Kirk Ballen. And he was so amazingly accepting. So yeah, that was the first place that I began to be out, was at the Unitarian Church. And at that time, the Unitarian Church was undergoing a process called becoming a welcoming congregation. And what that meant was that they would be welcoming to the LGBTQ community. So there was a conference that they had in somewhere in North Carolina, Durham or Chapel Hill or somewhere. And I remember going, and I remember it was the first time that, it was the very first time I remember being in a place where those two things were somewhat integrated. We were in a church building, I think that's just where we happened to have the conference, and we were singing songs that, you know, could have been considered spiritual or not, but it was a room full of gay and lesbian people, and it was like overwhelming for me because it was the first time, like I said, that those two pieces of who I was could be joined in the same place. So that was the beginning of my journey, was through the Unitarian Church. And then you're aware that there is a church in Roanoke called Metropolitan Community Church, the MCC. And when I first moved to Roanoke and I visited it, it was a little too Jesus-y for me. You know, I was still in that, pretty mad at God. And so I kind of had a push-pull relationship with MCC for a while. But maybe 10 years ago or so, I started pursuing a bit of a relationship with MCC.
What triggered the like movement to MCC from the Unitarian Church?
That's a good question. I don't know. I had my children when I was at the Unitarian Church because, in my experience, a lot of times becoming a parent prompts parents to want some sort of spiritual education for their children. So, I mean, I did want my children to have something, some sort of experience with the spiritual, with God. And so they were a part of the Unitarian Church. I don't know. You know, that's an interesting question. I'm not really remembering exactly what that shift was and how it changed, except that I guess I can say, in again, looking at myself, knowing my whole history, I'm a Jesus follower. That's the reality of who I am. It just took me a very long time to be able to own that at the same time that I own my sexual identity. So, you know, my children were also a part of MCC, you know, when they were younger.
So what has your experience at MCC been like? Because you mentioned it was very Jesus-like. Was it different by the time you moved?
No, it wasn't different. I was, you know, I have been a part of the MCC only since we've had the current pastor. And since MCC has been in existence here, there have been several different pastors. And so, you know, again, my experience, like with any church, is that church is very flavored by who the pastor is. So I can only speak for Metropolitan Community Church of the Blue Ridge as it is right now with Joe Cobb as the pastor. In my mind, Joe is an amazing person. He is very much out and open and inclusive, highly regarded and respected in the community, very involved, and very politically active, as well as enlightened and educated about all of these things that we've discussed, you know, the sexuality and the spirituality being integrated. So my experience there over the past 2 years has increased and deepened to the point that now I'm, you know, not only a member, but I'm a deacon. I'm very involved, very much a part of the leader, a leader of that particular church.
So just thinking about political involvement, like you mentioned, Joe Cobb was politically active. Do you consider yourself politically active?
Yeah. You touched on this earlier when you asked about First Friday, and I kind of went on. My experience with First Fridays was not that it was a political activist group. The reading group, the book study that I was a part of at Virginia Tech was a bit more focused on political activism, and I think that might have been part of the context of a college campus, a university, highly educated professional people. My experience with First Fridays is that it was a social club. It was primarily social activities. And by the time I landed here in the early 90s, I think it was really fading. It was fizzling out. I can't remember exactly, you know, how long I was involved or, you know, how much longer First Fridays even stuck around, but my sense is that it eventually just sort of dissolved, and so there was less political involvement. I didn't see myself very involved politically probably until Obama ran. And I think because up until that point, I was pretty disillusioned about the political system itself. And I woke up. I was very excited about Obama and very much on board and very much proud to be an American again and excited. So my political activism has been since then. And much more now at this point. Very much politically active and strong in fighting for what I feel is social justice for all people, for all minorities, not just the queer community, but for everyone that's really in jeopardy of losing rights at this particular time in our history.
I completely agree with you. I think that's a wonderful thing. So you're involved with the Diversity Center, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that tied to some of your political activism?
Perfectly tied to that. Yeah, the Roanoke Diversity Center just happens to be housed in the Metropolitan Community Church building. There is not a connection. So RDC is not necessarily a spiritual organization, but it is an amazing place of support and safety, again, for the LGBT community. And my experience has been it's been varied. I've kind of, you know, dipped my toes in the water of the RDC for maybe a year or two, but most recently, within the past year of my life, I feel like I've dived in head first, and that's because of getting involved with the Diversity Camp. Are you familiar with Diversity Camp? Diversity Camp is, we've had three camps, and it came about because some of the people at the Diversity Center have experiences of camp, primarily church camp. But again, camp is a wonderful experience. I personally had a lot of camp experience growing up. I would go to church camp every summer. I mentioned that our family was not particularly religious, but for some reason, I went to church camp, and I loved it. I don't know that I associated it with anything spiritual, but it was fun. You know, it's summer church camp. So what some people decided at RDC is to create that for the gay community. So like I said, we've had three summers. Last summer was my first time to be involved as a counselor. So there were maybe 50 young people, anywhere from we had a very young child, so there was like, I think maybe a 6-year-old, but typically they were, you know, kids anywhere from 12 to 25 or so, I think is the typical age range of the campers. And then for every couple of campers, they want to have a counselor. And most of the counselors are themselves part of the LGBT community. That summer, it's a week-long experience, an overnight camp, so everybody's staying there on the grounds. That experience opened me up to, first of all, this generation, which, again, you know, I was born in the 50s, and so my experience is very different than the experience of this generation. So that has been eye-opening and educating to me. I have had to learn a whole new language, words and terms that I have no idea what they mean. It's just a whole new language. But meeting people, young people, who are so brave and so clear at that age about who they are, which again is astounding to me. You've heard my story. You've heard how long and well, you know, it took me forever to come to a place of being sure of who I am, and to see someone who's 17, 18, 19, 20, and they know who they are, kudos. I'm just so excited for that person to have that experience. So going to camp as a counselor has changed me much more than I think anything that I could have possibly have given to the campers.
Wow, that's awesome. So you mentioned new terms and everything. Mm-hmm. Had any experience with like transgender people in general? I'm sure you had transgender campers.
Oh, definitely. This experience, like prior to diversity camp, not really very much understanding at all about transgender issues. But I would say that that particular topic is the one that has exploded the most for me, because I've met very many people who are transgender, and again, trying to understand and support their journey. I also have another sphere of my life. Within the past year, I've gotten involved with a couple of things that have been really the impetus for changing me personally. One is a Native American tradition called Naraya, and that is a sacred celebration and dance that is a Shoshone. It's from the Shoshone culture, the Shoshone tribe, and has been brought back to life. It's always been a part, but almost died out, like from, I think, maybe the 60s until just maybe the 80s. And so I've been really privileged to be a part of that. And that has been an experience that I've gone through once, and I'll do it again. It's an annual kind of thing. These dances happen throughout the country. The primary purpose is to dance for peace, to dance for our country, our culture, our world, and to dance with individual intentions, but to know that that's then going to influence and affect the world in which we live. And the amazing, wonderful thing about Naraya is that many of the people who participate are two-spirited, which in Native culture, historically, you're not going to read this in our American history books, but historically the truth is that most Native cultures honored and respected two-spirited people. Do you know what I'm talking about if I use that term, two-spirited?
From my understanding, it's someone they considered, like, what we would consider transgender.
Mm-hmm. Possibly, and I think it could be even broader than that, but definitely someone that, in our understanding of queer, you know, that not following the typical binary understanding of gender and gender identity. So, yeah, trans for sure, but I think it's even broader than just trans. But definitely having an honoring and a respect spiritually for someone who is of that. That's their nature. That's who they are. So the Naraya honors that, and many of the people who participate are two-spirited people. So that has had a big influence on me in my spiritual, sexual journey, and particularly because, like I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm a very strong Jesus follower, and yet I think that I love to use the illustration of a mountain, and that there are many, many paths to get to the top of that mountain. And what's important is that you get to the top of the mountain. And once you're at the top of the mountain, it's really insignificant how you got there. And so again, I think that's part of that stuff that our culture gets all wrapped up in saying, oh, got to go this path, got to go this path. No, 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 no. Just get to the top of the mountain. And I'm very much influenced and drawn to Native American spirituality. So that's been a part that's been significant for me. And that just has begun this past year. My first dance was last April.
You mentioned two parts. You had the Native American part, and then there's another.
You are a very good listener. The other part I mentioned to you the other day when we began to talk, and that is that I have been introduced to the world of radical fairies. And the world of radical fairies, that term and the definition actually was begun back in the 60s by a man named Harry Hay, a few other people. Harry Hay is considered the father, my understanding, like I'm not an expert or anything, but you know, my understanding is that part of what he was observing as a gay man in San Francisco in the 60s was that gay people at that point, and again, the difference between what was happening in California and what was happening for me maybe in Virginia, but that even then, gay people being out were just being assimilated into regular heterosexual culture, which meant that they were losing their unique, special gift that gay people bring to our culture. And that's the part that I've grabbed a hold of, that I truly believe in, that gay culture, queer culture, brings a uniqueness and a giftedness to our overall culture, and that to stamp that out, to try to push that away or to deny it, is missing a huge piece of inclusive diversity and beauty and color and wonderment that we need, our world really needs. So that's the fairy part, is that obviously he was encouraging, and it was primarily begun with gay men. And for many people who consider themselves radical fairies, there's still a bit of that division between male and female. And that has historically been a part of the gay rights movement, is that very often men and women have had a hard time playing together, gay men and lesbians, and very often there's been that split. Not always, and I think we work hard to try to make some peace with all of that. But the radical part, of course, has to do with politics and what was going on in the 60s. And it's interesting to me, I feel so much like I have come full circle, that here I am in my 60s, I'm 63, and I start out back here, the hippie movement, the Jesus movement. The Jesus movement was very hippie-ish with Jesus at the core, so it was all very much alike. And then I went through this dead period where I felt like I was just totally blinders on, unaware, uninvolved. And now I've come back to this place that I feel like my eyes are open. And I'm suddenly, I have an awareness of politics, radical politics. I have an awareness of my own identity as a queer person. And I have an acceptance and an inclusiveness of that whole spectrum of queer, again, like you said, including trans, which I have gotten to meet. One of my very closest friends is a person born male who is now identifying female and yet maintaining what appears to me a beautiful balance between male and female. And this is someone that I've met through this whole radical fairy community that exists around the country and around the world, actually. So, yeah, all of that has turned my world upside down.
So you mentioned it changed how you looked at things, but did it change how you, the radical fairy movement, did that change how you expressed yourself as well?
Yeah, definitely. Wow, pretty good question. You know, I mentioned that there's been this lifelong struggle to make peace between the sexuality and the spirituality. And for the longest time, I really thought that it had to do just with homosexuality, that it just had to do with me being a lesbian. But my experience with the radical fairies and with some of the... There are some intentional communities around the country, and so I've actually gone in this past year, I've spent more time at one of these intentional communities than I have in Virginia, and I'm getting ready to go again just in another month. So being around these people who are living there, living the life, really immersed in these practices and these understandings has done a lot to open my eyes, and I don't even know how to explain it except to say that I've had an understanding and a realization that for me, I was very caught up in our culture's oppression of sexuality, period. Not just homosexuality, but sexuality. I think that religious overtones particularly, but I think culture as well is very oppressive of people being sexual creatures and truly expressing that, whether that's as a straight person or a queer person. And so, yeah, all of a sudden, I feel like I've come into this full understanding of who I am. It has changed how I look. It has changed how I feel about myself. It has changed my relationships, the people that I'm willing to fall in love with. It's all very much changed.
With the sex positivity, do you feel like your relationships are better than they were? Because you noted that was a lot of tension between you and Nancy early on.
Yes, for sure. Sex positivity, that must be one of those terms that I'm not familiar with. Okay, check it off. There's another one to add to my repertoire. Hadn't heard that one before. Yeah, sure. So I guess that's true. For me, finally, sex has become a positive thing. Whereas you're right, with Nancy, I loved her, and our relationship was sexual, but it wasn't positive. At least not for me, because of the conflict I had so much. So, wow, what an amazing way to put it. Yes, you know, in having this freedom and this understanding within myself, it has brought me to the place within this past year where, yeah, I've been able to have relationships that have been more genuine, more authentic, not enshrouded in shame or guilt. And those are the two things. Those are the two demons that have followed me all my life. I tend to think in terms of metaphors and illustrations. And when I think about this past year and how I describe it, it feels like for most of my life, I've been chained at the bottom of the ocean. And suddenly, the chain has been broken, and I have just exploded to the top. And that's a freedom and a wonderment that I'm so grateful for, and that I do give God credit for. Because again, I'm convinced that as much as the people who would scream and yell about what God thinks and what God is telling us, I don't buy any of it. In my understanding, God wants us to have that sex positivity, that we experience the beauty and the wonder of our bodies and of being erotic and of being connected and open with one another. So I'm grateful to finally be at that place.
That's a lot of personal growth within the last year. So do you think it was the involvement in these different communities that really had spurred that on? Or
I think it's been my whole life journey. I mean, again, you talked about stepping stones, and was this a stepping stone? You know, all of my life has been a stepping stone. And so I can look at this past year and say, whoosh, things have exploded. But obviously, we have to give credit to, I've been moving along in this direction for a long time. But I will tell you that there were days that I thought I'd never get to where I am now. There are days that I thought I would go to my grave still with that sense of oppression and shame covering my sense of my sexuality, my sensuality, my sense of myself. I've always been uncomfortable in my body, and I realize that that goes back to early years of having been sexually abused. And again, didn't even really make any connection between any of that until, you know, again, at various places in this journey. But again, that's all gone as well. That years and years and years of feeling displaced in my body, feeling uncomfortable in my body, it's just not there anymore. It's gone.
That's wonderful. We're almost at about an hour, so
okay.
We're about ready to wrap up. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think we've covered a lot. Is there anything else that you want to add as far as a question to wrap it up? Or, I mean, I think we've covered a lot.
Do you know where you plan to go from here?
Just living life with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and joy, and being a light in the darkness. Even though I look at your generation and I'm so proud of you guys, I'm so proud that we've come to where we are, there's still a lot of darkness. And I think that, you know, I bring something as an elder to say, you know, I've lived a year or two. I know a little bit about what life is like, and I can learn from you, I can learn from this generation, but I also bring a lot of love and a lot of stability. So I think what lies ahead is just I'm continuing to be around as many young people as I can, because that keeps me young, keeps me alive, and I think it offers whatever it is I can offer to young people too. So that's where I'm going.
Perfect. Well, thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.